मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहम् न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेर्न मेय चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा। शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, greetings, love, namaste, and welcome to our third class on the Yoga Sutra. We ended our last class on the sutra, "The pain that is yet to come can and should be avoided." And in my experience, this fundamental decision that opens the door to yoga is a decision that you don't want to suffer anymore. And I want to just begin to discern the difference between pain and suffering. Pain is normal and it's natural and it happens to all of us sometimes several times a day, depending on our situation and on the state of our body. And normally, pain dissolves when the situation or the body part heals or in some way receives relief. But there's something in the mind that causes us to believe that we need to hang on to pain, something that makes us believe that pain is good or that it's necessary or that we deserve it or that it says something about us. And that's when pain becomes suffering. That tendency, of course, starts in childhood. And of course, the more we identify with our pain and with what it says about us, the more we suffer it, and the more we etch that suffering into our inner being. And this is how we create what Eckhart Tolle calls the pain body, which is another name for the karmic backpack, and which really is the cause of suffering, at least when it's connected and engineered by the experience of ignorance. So the Yoga Sutra is really all about the way out of that, and therefore I'm very happy to be entering into it on this particular day, at this particular time, as the headlines around the world get stranger and stranger, and we realize that we don't have to be at the effect of the external, if we know how to recognize what suffering is and where it comes from, and especially when we're willing to accept the pain that arises, that inevitably arises, without committing ourselves to suffering. And that profound distinction is really one of the gifts of yoga. So let's find our posture of tapas, very much grounding through the sits bones and the hips and thighs and buttocks, lifting up through the central body all the way up through the crown, and lifting your scapular muscles so that the torso becomes upright and open. And see if once having created this posture, you can soften in it. Somehow find that subtle balance point between absolute focus and softening, relaxation, opening. And as we begin, we'll chant the opening mantras. Om Namah Shivaya Gurave, the invocation to the primordial goddess, the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. And in settling ourselves here, find your presence on the shores of the lake. Find your awareness in the space of consciousness around the Great Lake, Manasarovar. And feel how you're here facing the deep blue waters that carry the memory of so many generations of yogis who sat beside it. And be aware that all of us are sitting around the lake with you. And with that sense of presence at the lake, we'll chat and then we'll go into our initial meditation. You can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra or place your right hand over the center of your chest and the left hand on top of that. Om. Om. Namah Shivaya Gurave Satchitananda Murataye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. And the mantras to the primordial goddess. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Triambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. And the mantras invoking the grace of the original sage of the Yoga Sutra. Vande Gurunam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase Jangalika Yamane Samsara Hala Halamoha Shantyai Abahu Purushakaram Shankha Chakra Siddharinam Sahasra Shirasam Shvetam Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim Pranamami Patanjalim. Now, as you sit at the lake, having invoked the presence of the primordial consciousness itself, the primordial Shakti, and the sages who have channeled this teaching for us, be aware of all of the great beings, the guides, the masters, the yogis, some of the people that you love, who have been important in your life, all sitting with us. And allow yourself to recognize that we are in this place together where awareness very naturally cleanses itself of any of its qualities of suffering and darkness and becomes pristine and precise, where reality can be experienced at its most primordial level. And let yourself feel the love and awareness that flows off the lake like mist and draws us together, embracing us in its folds. And at this moment, become aware of the heart space, the space inside the heart. And feel for now as though the space of the heart extends outward through the front of your body, about two hands distance in front of you, to each side and to the back, so that you're sitting inside the sphere of the heart, which is much greater, much bigger than your physical body, and whose edges actually can dissolve into the great consciousness and the great heart. imagine that in the center of the extended heart space, the expanded heart space, is a lotus whose petals are made of light. And in the center of the lotus, find the flame, the heart flame, the flame of the self. And allow the breath as it flows in to flow in and touch the flame so that the breath kindles your awareness of the light at the center of your heart. And as you exhale, feel the space around the heart gently expanding. The breath flows in with hum, flows out with sa, constantly reminding you that your nature is that flame and the consciousness behind and within it. And recognize that this same flame is within every heart gathered here together, and indeed within every heart everywhere on the planet, and in the invisible realms, the invisible worlds that surround and are part of this planet. And with that understanding, imagine that you're holding in your hand a candle lit with the visible form of that internal flame. Place in the flame your intention for this evening. And place that candle on the lake. We ask that our practice this evening be of benefit to all beings, that it bring healing to all those who need healing, that it bring expansion and light to all those who need it, that all beings be free of suffering, both external suffering and inner suffering, and that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that all of us be free of grasping, hatred, and dullness. And we ask that we experience as a felt experience, not just an intellectual awareness, the absolute equality of all that is. Now let your attention with the breath flow into the flame in the heart, and let the exhalation flow from the flame, creating a radiance around your entire body. The inhalation flows in with hum, the exhalation with sa. And the recognition is, I am that radiance. I breathe that radiance into all that is. Suffering, as it turns out, is the product of the mind. And so if we can say that the fundamental decision that opens the door to yoga is the decision that you don't want to suffer anymore, the number two realization, I actually call it Yoga 101, is the recognition that your experience is determined by the state of the mind. And, of course, there are lots of ways to put this because it is Yoga 101, which means that pretty much every text, certainly in the Indian traditions, Hinduism and Buddhism and in other traditions as well, make this front and center. So you can say the world is as you see it. You can say the mind is your world. But in my experience, the more we're willing to accept this and actually work with it skillfully, the more yoga gathers its momentum in us and our mind really begins to transform. So, of course, most of us have known this for years and have been practicing with it for years. And I personally am not different in that, in other words, I keep realizing it over and over and over again. Oh my God, my experience is totally dependent on the state of my mind. But it's really very easy to forget when you look at the world that you're looking through the filter of your thoughts and how many of these thoughts are actually determined by the kleshas. So, you know, there we are, wondering, to quote Bob Dylan's song, which I think we can almost call an ancient song now. It's maybe 50 years old at this point. Here I sit so patiently waiting to find out what price I have to pay to get out of going through these things twice, the great lament of karmic circumstance. So the sutra keeps coming back again and again and again to this main point, which is that what determines our state of mind is primarily where we identify, what we identify ourselves. So the Yoga Sutra says again and again, and we're going to work with this sutra again today, that the union of the seer with what is seen, of pure consciousness with its objects, is the cause of suffering, pure and simple. So the first treatment, so to speak, for suffering is to start to detach your consciousness from what you believe you are. And that means from anything you believe you are. In other words, to the degree to which you're able to not identify consciousness with anything knowable, that's the degree to which you're going to be free of suffering. And believe me, that is not easy. But thank God for the path. It does become easier and easier as we soak the mind like a tea bag in the water of these teachings. Actually, the water is the mind. The tea bag is the teachings. So as we dunk the tea bag of the teachings into the water of consciousness, the water of the mind begins to be dyed with the teachings. And therefore, the mind begins to recognize in a more and more natural way when it's identifying with something that it's not its true nature, and to be able to let go of it. The next group of sutras we're going to work with sutras 18 to 26, which are the precursor sutras to the very famous sutras on the limbs of yoga, which is we're going to start with next week. This particular set of sutras, among other things, lays out the basic metaphysics of Sankhya philosophy, which is the underpinning of the Yoga Sutra. And I'm going to talk about this a bit today because it is actually helpful to understand the traditional understanding or the context with which a traditional student would approach the text. And interestingly enough, that understanding, if you really delve into it, is actually not so different from the tantric understanding. So let me explain this. So the popular view of Sankhya says that there is a duality between Purusha, the pure consciousness, that's the soul of the universe, as it were, and Prakriti, the manifest universe itself. In other words, the popular understanding of Sankhya is that it is kind of the hotbed of the split between spirit and matter. However, if you really understand Sankhya Yoga, which means understanding some of the other texts that are part of this worldview, especially the Bhagavad Gita, you start to realize that Sankhya Yoga is actually much subtler and much closer to non-dual Vedanta and non-dual Tantra than it is popularly supposed to be. And in this subtler understanding, Purusha and Prakriti, consciousness and the creative power that Sankhya calls Prakriti, which we call Shakti in our tradition. Purusha and Prakriti are eternal. They're the two aspects of the one source. Purusha, like Shiva, is pure consciousness without an object. Prakriti is the creative power that manifests universes in it herself. And here's the key point. Since the cause of everything is the creative activity of divine consciousness, and since the cause is always present in the effect, we ourselves are fully manifestations of the divine energies within Prakriti and the loving intention of Purusha. In other words, we are Prakriti Purusha, we are Shiva Shakti. And this means that this is true even though during the manifestation process, the vast soul that Sankhya calls Purusha and the tantric traditions call Shiva appears to break up into numerous individual forms, kind of atoms of consciousness, each with its own swabhava, or individual understanding and feeling about itself. Individual understanding is pretty much the opposite of I am that. It's pretty much, you know, the understanding of I am a woman, I am Sally, I am good looking, I am not so great looking, I come from a happy family, etc., etc. And as we gradually become more and more identified with that individual consciousness and lose touch with our fundamental connection with the divine, we accumulate deeper and deeper experiences of the kleshas and the samskaras that form as a result. And as we've been seeing, it's those samskaras and kleshas that cause the trouble, that veil the pure consciousness. It's us, which form the filter through which we see ourselves in the world. So most of the yogic interventions that we work with, pretty much in all the traditions, are basically intended to change the filter, to substitute a more positive screen for the negative ones. And this becomes actually possible once we begin to understand that we're seeing through a filtration system. In other words, if you realize that what you think about yourself and everything else is actually a filter over reality, then you can start to recognize that what you're choosing to focus on and the way you're choosing to understand it is completely skewing your vision, and that basically in the normal course of things, you can't really trust what you believe is true. I recently heard an interview that Krista Tippett, you know, the woman who runs the podcast On Being, did with a psychotherapist who's a black guy who works with racial issues, or he works with people uncovering their racial issues in group settings. And he mentioned on the podcast that when he's doing one of these programs, he will often say to the people in the room, understand this, you are not defective. You are not defective. And he said that when he says this, invariably, a lot of people in the audience, especially African-American people, will burst into tears, because what they suddenly realize is that their internalized racial prejudice has given them the feeling that they're defective. You know, and this is something that's extremely strong in people who get those kind of messages from the family and from society, but it's also present, as you know, in all of us. Every one of us has, to some extent, the feeling of being defective. And to the degree to which we focus on that, or let me change that, we don't even have to focus on it, to the degree to which we see ourselves in the world through that filter, that's the degree to which we experience a skewed vision of the world in which we disempower ourselves. But what is also true, once we start to realize that, when you start to realize that you have a filter, you also start to realize that you can shift your inner experience simply by shifting your focus. And, you know, I'll just give you a very simple example. Most of us feel expanded when we look at the sky or when we look at the ocean. Because when our consciousness is filled with these expansive energies of sky and sea, there's just a natural letting go. There's a natural opening. There's a natural relaxation. So the identification here of spaciousness of sky and ocean with expansion is natural. It's actually the result of a brain process involving our mirror neurons, you know, because where our inner state mirrors what we're seeing on the outside or what we believe is the outside. So when you look at the sky or imagine the sky, the mind becomes skylight, even if there are other thoughts in the way. And this affects your entire system, your blood pressure, the release of hormones in your body. Just close your eyes now, and we'll do a practice from the Vijnana Bhairava, one I really love and that I think many of you have done with me before. Imagine that your head is the sky. Just feel that an entirely blue, cloudless sky stretches in all directions. And that your mind is that, your head is that. And see if you can notice the effect on your body of having that vision, that view. Now into that sky-like awareness, bring the thought of a storm, a raging storm. See if you can imagine a storm with the trees shaking and the wind whipping, the sky filled with thunderclouds, rain pouring down. What happens to your mind? And now create in your mind a picture of a calm ocean, as though you were lying on a raft, surrounded by aquamarine water, as though you were in the tropics or in Hawaii or Jamaica or another tropical place. And notice how your mind feels, how your body feels. So bring your awareness back to the breath. Maybe for some of you, you've never left the breath. And now bring into your mind something that you're worried about. And I'm going to suggest that it be something from the news, or it can be something very personal, but just bring into your mind something that worries you. Focus on it. If you can notice what the effect is in your body. What happens in your muscles? What happens to your breathing? See if you can notice that there's a kind of natural contraction that occurs around thoughts of worry or fear or sadness, and how these thoughts actually create an entire experience in your body as well as in your inner mind. I know this isn't new to you, but there is something I find about actually watching the process, which usually is so automatic that we just take it for granted, and just recognizing that every one of these visualizations is going to change your heart rate. They'll cause stress hormones to course through your bloodstream or open up the parasympathetic nervous system and the relaxation response. They'll affect your digestion. They'll change your breathing. And eventually, as you keep holding worried thoughts or open thoughts in your mind, they'll remake your inner body in their own image. Because your body-mind is made of this infinitely fluid consciousness stuff that literally changes according to the input. And these results aren't just going on inside you, because we project our own feelings outward onto the environment and we experience other people through the eyes of our filtration system. So in extreme cases, we call this tendency paranoia, where someone imagines that everyone is plotting against them. But even normal people, so to speak, see the world through the filters of the mind. If you notice how you tend to look at somebody walking towards you, let's say an unshaven man wearing a hoodie and ragged clothes or very untidy clothes, you're going to probably have a natural tendency to tense up. If you have a fear of authority etched in your mind, it's going to be very hard for you to be comfortable around your boss. And if you have a crush on somebody, when you run into that person, their every look and gesture is freighted with significance. And of course, because minds influence each other, other people catch our attitudes and respond to us in kind, all because of the mirror neurons in the brain. At least that's what neuroscientists tell us. But what the yoga texts tell us is that the mirror neurons are actually the physical instruments that consciousness uses in order to create a world that allows it to experience itself, work out our karmas, and create transformation in this tapestry of reality. You know, we live with this ever-changing quality of the mind, this reflective, creative quality of the mind. And what we eventually learn, if we're clever, is to change our experience of life by using the mind's powers to give ourselves a better experience of it. You know, as Vyasa says in his commentary on the sutras, if you want to protect your feet from being cut by gravel, don't try to cover the earth with leather. Instead, wear shoes. And, you know, of course, the shoes are your practices. The shoes are actually your ability to look at your thoughts, change them when necessary, and finally go beyond them to the observer of thoughts. And, of course, I don't have to tell you that this is the basis of the New Thought Movement, the Law of Attraction, the Course in Miracles, many forms of contemporary psychotherapy. In other words, this understanding is not only the secret of liberation, it's also the secret of living a fairly happy life. And I do believe that's why the yogic texts spend so much time reminding us how important it is to detach our observing consciousness from our samskaras. Because basically, that's the way to get past the filters, or to see through the filters. The word consciousness, of course, literally means the ability to know or be aware, to be conscious, It's the quality of being, of knowingness. And, you know, consciousness can be a wide field of awareness. It's consciousness is completely fluid. It can go wide, it can go big, it can also be laser-like, focusing on one or two objects. When consciousness widens, when it becomes big, then it actually becomes possible to experience the objects and the thoughts and the feelings as arising and subsiding inside this field. When consciousness becomes laser-like, when it zeroes in on something, then that object that it zeroes in on pretty much takes over. It becomes our world. You know, and every time you focus on something, you essentially pick out a particular object, direct your attention towards it, and this blocks out other objects. So, you know, when you're looking at the computer screen, your eyes can be open. There can be a room around you. In fact, an entire Starbucks, if you like to work in coffee houses. But you're pretty much blind to it because you're focused on the screen. And it's the same when you focus on a particular thought or emotion. Everything else falls away, and that thought or feeling becomes your reality. And this is highly problematic, of course, when that thought or feeling is a painful one or one that's likely to lead to pain. But when you can turn your attention past the emotion to the part of you that's aware of it, then in that very moment, the pure cognizing quality of consciousness gets liberated. And then for that moment, consciousness itself becomes your world. And if you do that powerfully enough, then it allows you to work with whatever comes up in your life without necessarily getting stuck in the painful aspects of your experience. We're going to be doing a series of small practices for tuning into cognizance. And we're going to do a couple of them now. We'll come back to them. We'll use them in conjunction with observing thoughts. And here's a very simple one. Just think to yourself, "Hi, darling," and then notice that there's something hearing that thought. Think to yourself, "Hi, darling," and turn your attention to what it is that's hearing the thought. Where is it? What is that? And just try it again. "Hi, darling. What hears it?" Now, can you keep some part of your attention on that part of you that's able to hear the voice in your mind, knowing, of course, as I know you do, that this is consciousness, this is the inner witness. This is that part of your individual consciousness that in the Yoga Sutra's breakdown of the human organism is called the buddhi, the awake part of you. Now I want to ask you to bring in a negative thought, one that really actually generally works to bring you down. And it could be a worry, it can be a fear, it can be a judgment that you have about yourself or somebody else. Just bring it in, make it big. Let it fill your mind. As we were doing earlier, notice the effects in your body. And now see if you can notice the part of you that's aware both of the thought and of its effects. And see if you can toggle, see if you can go back and forth between holding on to that negative thought form or image and that witnessing part of your consciousness. back and forth. Negative thought, inner witness. Negative thought, inner witness. Try not to space out. Now see if you can bring the largest part of your attention to the one who's aware that you're hearing my voice and which is also aware of your inner state and your thoughts, whatever thoughts are coming up. This really is the basic process for starting to discern our samskaras, our thought forms, whether they're mental samskaras or physical samskaras, for being able to discern the difference between our samskaras and consciousness itself. So you just start by separating the thought from the knower of the thought. And the next stage is being able to discern helpful and uplifting thoughts from thoughts that entangle you more and more in suffering. And, of course, that discernment, that ability to discern what liberates you from what gets you more stuck, gets honed more and more with practice. But it really actually is the core task of the sadhana of the Yoga Sutras, especially in the beginning, but also right along the path, because once you learn how to recognize the filters and step out of them even for a couple of minutes, you actually start to interact with Prakriti as she is, because Prakriti is the stuff of your mind. She's also, of course, the stuff of your thoughts. But when you can begin to feel into the quality of your own inner Prakriti, the way your mind field shifts and changes according to its contents, you actually start to recognize ultimately the divinity that is your nature, that is the natural part even of your most individuated consciousness. And of course, when you learn how to step out of the filters, when you learn how to step past the thoughts that filter experience, you also begin to see the external world in a very different way. So the more you see through the filters, the more you learn how to see, how to interact with both the world around you and the inner field of your unique individual mind field, your unique individual consciousness, as expressions of something divine and timeless, which have their own flow, which are constantly in motion, and which we can interact with and influence in quite positive ways once we can start to separate our own filtration system from what we're seeing and interacting. This is the moment when you can begin to see clearly ourself as pure awareness and then begin to connect our own awareness to the great awareness, to what we're calling in this text Ishwara, pure consciousness. So the small self can start to see itself as part of the great self, And this is a tremendously subtle realization, and though it's said differently here than it is in Shaivism or in the Bhagavad Gita, what all these texts are really saying is that not only the self you contact in deep meditation, but every part of you, your mind and senses and body, are intrinsically divine because they're all inextricably composed of particles of creative energy, Prakriti or Shakti. And in order to really free ourselves from the prison of our own samskaras, we have to somehow learn how to both step past the samskaras, the karmic situations, into the witness, and also to start to recognize that everything, even the samskaras, are part of the field of Prakriti and therefore divine. And that process, that practice of learning to free ourselves from samskaras by becoming the witness of them, and then tuning back into the samskaras and realizing that they are all fluidly arising and subsiding within the field of Prakriti, which is the primordial field of the divine, or of the goddess, if you prefer that term, that's when we're really in the game of freedom. So until we can do that, we're going to keep falling into the world that our samskaras create for us, wanting what our samskaras tell us will make us happy, disliking what our samskaras tell us will make us unhappy, and we stay stuck in the past because what it actually means to be at the mercy of our karmas and our reactive patterns, what it means is that we are at the mercy of our past, because that's what samskaras are. They're holdovers from the past. Your samskaric mind only knows how to react in terms of what you already know. Whether you're a normally neurotic person seeing a therapist for help with your problems, or a yogi really making the effort to liberate your mind and body from the karmic backpack in order to know the truth about yourself, you're always going to start by activating the objective observing part of the mind. The Buddhist psychotherapist Dan Siegel, whom I know many of you have read, connects the inner observer, the witness, to a region in the prefrontal cortex which is able to detach, you know, which is the part of the brain that apparently can detach from the other brain states and just watch them. You know, he points out that if you're undergoing psychotherapy, that once you can do that, once you can activate the inner observer, then you can look at the situations in your life with enough objectivity that you can start to choose the appropriate reaction. You can start to make decisions based on the observer rather than being completely activated by the samskaras. Some part of us just has to take very seriously the need to step aside from the feelings and the stories and observe them. Observe how your state changes through different reactions, because that's the only way you'll ever recognize the possibility of getting free of them. What I think many of you have discovered is that as you get more and more access to the witness, it also gives you access to a particularly valuable inner skill, which is the skill of assessing your felt inner experience. In other words, of checking in with yourself and understanding how particular situations and particular reactions and particular thoughts make you feel, so that you can start to notice when you feel relaxed or stressed, what your body feels like when it's anxious, what your pulse is like when you're peaceful. And then you can begin to tune into the felt experience itself and see if you can find the roots of that particular experience. You know, for instance, a friend of mine came into my house the other day we are social distance buddies, and she was very, very upset. And I could feel her upset. It was kind of difficult to be around her. It was, you know, she was speaking fast, her breath was irregular, and I was finding it kind of annoying, you know, because of the mirror neurons, her agitated state was beginning to affect me. So I said, kind of, not that patiently, I wasn't being a therapist, I was, you know, being a friend, sort of trying to make things more comfortable between us. And I said, so what's up? You know, I can feel you being stressed, and you know, what's going on? What's happening? And she stopped for a minute. She kind of, I could see her sort of turning inside. And she said, finally, okay, about 3 hours ago, I got a call from my mother who told me that her sister, my aunt, is just going into the hospital for cancer tests and that they're very worried about her. And I've had a very, you know, busy day. I put it out of my mind, but I realize that's lingering with me, that's staying with me, it's affecting me. And so she was able in that moment to go back into the moment of hearing this news, reacting to it, and work with the feeling, which in this case what she did was say a prayer for her aunt, which gave her the feeling that she was, you know, intervening in some way, that she was making it better. And it allowed her to let go of it. But, you know, this is a really simple, kind of normal, stressful situation. But it actually changes the way we experience our inner world once we are willing to witness ourselves, because, you know, a friend isn't always there to do it for us, and just ask why is this happening. And what we'll often find is that behind the event, there is an assumption, there's a samskara, there's a belief, there's an old experience. And that's when we can begin to use a current feeling of discomfort to help us unpick an old one. Because, of course, the main thing that disempowers us is our belief that everything would be great if we could just get the world to behave better. I want to share with you one of my primary samskaras. One of the defining events of my early life happened when I was 18 months old and my younger brother was born. And suddenly I was no longer the sole focus of my mother's attention. So as happens, you know, this is a classic sibling situation, I suffered hugely, and I can still remember the feeling of it because my mother's attention was my whole world and it felt like I was losing my ground. And the way I chose to deal with it, or the way I was driven to deal with it, was by getting really angry at my mother and constantly trying to punish her in various ineffective ways. Now, another child might have reacted by becoming super sweet and seductive. Another child might have just faded into silence or become super helpful to his mom. My reaction was to get angry. And, you know, reactions like this, many of them put in place long before we understand much of anything, and to some extent mediated by past karma, then become the root of our samskaras around love and safety and competence and whatever else happens. They represent the strategies that our particular karmic style finds natural and comfortable, and I'm sure every one of you has a version of this story, some feeling state that happened before you had really any control of your emotions that imprinted itself, and that became the core of one of your strategies for working in the world. And, you know, here's the thing that I came to realize when I started working on myself is that even though the way we react to experience and the experiences that we react to, especially in early childhood, are very often the result of our destined karma, nonetheless, every new thought or word or action or way we describe it to ourselves forms grooves that deepen the samskaras and determine how our future relationships will be experienced. And this is the mechanism reacting and having effect of our reactions can either be have the effect of embedding us more and more deeply in our suffering, or of becoming a way of learning what works to make us happy and what doesn't. And the way we manage this is by our capacity to be a witness and monitor our state. You know, the pleasure and suffering we experience are the result of reactive patterns. But if we are willing to self-monitor, we eventually learn to navigate both the world and our own mind, and we learn that some strategies are helpful and some strategies aren't. Eventually, the world begins to meet us in a different way. In my own case, I eventually learned that you cannot get people to love you by punishing them for not loving you as much as you think they should. And it took me about 25 years and a lot of broken relationships and a lot of tears to get this. But I can honestly say that the world Prakriti, the objective world, taught me this lesson. And that once I learned it, I was able to discover better strategies for giving and receiving love, and everything about my life became happier. And, you know, in Sutra 18, I think you were wondering when we were going to get to the sutras, right? Patanjali points this out, thus setting out for us what yoga believes to be the beauty of the manifest world, at least where it concerns human souls. He says, the objective world, composed of elements and senses and having the inherent properties of the three gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, that is illumination, action, and stability, the objective world has a twofold purpose, fulfillment and freedom. And this is a really significant sutra. I'm going to define the words in a few minutes, and we'll spend a little time looking at some of the metaphysics behind it. But the fundamental point he's making here is that we don't come into the world just to escape it, you know, just to become yogis and liberate ourselves from matter. We come to learn how to enjoy it, which also means learning how to decode the messages that reality gives us about ourselves and our reactions and what we need to look at, and how to use the world itself to inspire growth. So in other words, what he's saying is that the world is here for us. And when we say that the world is here for us, we don't just mean the stuff that seems to make us happy, but also the stuff that confronts us painfully. So it's here for us in two ways, to provide us with an arena within which we can fulfill our natural longings for love, for mastery, for wisdom, you know, in which we can expand and do stuff and learn stuff. But it's also here to free us from believing the bullshit that the kleshas keep feeding us, so that we can actually experience this world as what my guru used to call a play of consciousness, a dance that's meant to be enjoyable. So the world is here to fulfill us, to teach us, and fulfillment means, it doesn't mean just fulfillment of pleasure, it means fulfillment of soul growth. One of my favorite contemporary teachers, H. Almas, defines the goals of spiritual life in two ways. He says that self-realization, which is what the Yoga Sutra would call fulfillment, is one form of, one of the objects of spiritual practice. It's to realize all the powers and potentialities of ourself, in every sense of the word, you know, our great self and also our embodied self. And the other goal of spiritual growth, of course, is liberation, meaning liberation from our painful samskaras. So the freedom part of the equation starts when we begin to work with the roots of our karmas. And I think we can agree, and the yoga tradition certainly does, that the reason we keep being born here again and again is so that we'll master the relationship between real fulfillment, you know, the fulfillment that actually satisfies us, not the kind of fake fulfillment, pseudo-fulfillment that many of us settle for, but you know, the difference between real fulfillment and fake fulfillment and the difference between real freedom and fake freedom. And a lot of this has to do with their skill at working with their own karmas. And I'm going to give you another example of this. It's a well-known psychological truth that we tend to marry or get into romantic partnerships and friendship relationships, actually, with partners who mirror the relationship we had with a parent, usually the one we were most enmeshed with, but often simply the one whose gender mirrors the gender we're sexually attracted to. And this is usually unconscious, and it often takes a while to recognize what we're doing because, you know, when we enter a romantic partnership, we're usually kind of blinded by love and lust and the kind of tendency to idealize our partner. But sooner or later, the truth comes out because the unconscious driver for picking that person is to kind of lock ourselves into a situation in which we can face into some aspect of that original relationship and somehow fix it, heal it, transform it. And it's, and often, you know, we'll fight and have conflict with our partner until we realize that the goal is not to finally get what we didn't get from our parents, but to actually fix the original pain in a way that frees us from it through awareness and understanding and hopefully mutual love. So in such a case, the marriage can become the arena through which we can, if we're discerning, learn to see the samskaras that caused our relationship suffering in the first place, and then to heal them by healing our own perspective. And of course, the therapeutic transference is another way we can do this. Part of the genius of combining Western psychology with Eastern yogic teachings is that we now know how to create karmic situations, situations that will help us replay old karmas, old sufferings, but do it consciously so that they transform. We now know how to do this. We have skills for doing this. And, you know, and I would say also that this is part of what spiritual communities are designed to do. Spiritual communities are famous for being challenging interpersonally, especially traditional spiritual communities. You know, if you've ever been part of a spiritual community or even done a long in-person retreat, you know that personal relationships in such communities can be really fraught. They can bring up all your old relationship issues, whether positively or negatively. And, you know, I've been on retreats where people started major love affairs, met somebody, fell in love, left their partner of 20 years under the influence of, you know, the love that often comes up in a retreat. And I've been on retreats where people got so angry at somebody else that they needed a major intervention in order to keep the peace. You know, the atmosphere of a marriage or of a really volatile therapeutic relationship or of a community is perfectly calibrated for giving you a laboratory for working through your karmas, and it's incredibly valuable. My guru was once asked how he works on people's egos, and he said, "I don't have to work on people's egos. I just put people together and they work on each other." But my point is that this applies to every situation we find ourselves in, which is one reason why you can't really escape the world by going to a spiritual community. Wherever you go, you're going to be presented by situations that allow you, that repeat unprocessed karmas, so that you're getting the opportunity to deal with them by having them replay until you either work it out or really detach from it. Learn how to go, "Oh my God, there goes that, you know, stupid tendency to compare myself with better-looking people or compare my spiritual attainment to others. There it goes again. I can just watch it pass by." And this is really one of the reasons, I think, why we take birth in this world. So let's find our posture. And bring your awareness to the breath. Again, allowing the breath to flow in and out of the heart center, the heart space. Feeling the breath arising and subsiding from a space about 2 hands distance or 2 fists distance in front of our chest, behind our chest, and on each side. So, in other words, the breath is being received. It's flowing from this space around the body into the heart. You don't have to make an effort to do this. Just widen your sense of what the body is so that you recognize that your personal energy field is actually bigger than your physical body, so that the breath is flowing in. From all sides, flowing into the heart, opening your awareness of the heart lotus and the flame, accompanied by the sound of hum, sa, hum on the inhalation, sa on the exhalation. Now, even as the breath is flowing with Hansa, and I hope giving you a sense of taking rest in yourself, taking rest in the heart, become aware of that in you that knows you're meditating and that at this moment is hearing my voice. Become aware of the witness of your experience. As you do, as you turn your consciousness back on itself, as you become aware of this quality in yourself that actually allows you to experience your meditation, to be conscious of your thoughts, to be conscious of the process that you're in any moment. I'm going to ask you to do something that may sound strange, but I'm going to ask you to sense into this witnessing consciousness and then to imagine that you're moving backwards into it. That the witness is actually a presence, a field, and you can bring your individual self sense into the field of the witness and just allow yourself to fall back into it. not your body, but that part of you that feels like me. You're letting your personal sense of being, call it your ego if you will, fall back into the field of the knower, the witnessing awareness. And if you get lost or confused, come back to the heart and the breath, then come back to the witness. And so to speak, place your self-sense, your me-ness, into the witness. And let the witness open up and take in your self-sense. And please come back to the heart. Part of what we're trying to do here in this particular class is expand our sense of what our consciousness is and what our consciousness can do, how it can expand and how it can contract. And in aid of this, I want to open up to a little bit more of the sage Vyasa's commentary on this sutra that we've been working with, Sutra 18, which says that the world consisting of elements and gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, its purpose is fulfillment and freedom. According to Vyasa, the basic nature of prakriti, of shakti, is innate creativity, which in the Yoga Sutras is called the power to transform. In other words, prakriti's intrinsic transformative power is what she's all about. This power of prakriti is what lets plants grow. It's what lets our digestion break down food. You know, it's the power that draws bees to pollen. And of course, it operates through the mind and senses, which means that our thoughts and feelings and bodies are constantly being transformed. So some of this transformation appears to be within our control, you know, as when you work hard to fill a blank page with words or knead flour and water to make bread or master a yoga pose or anything else, learn to drive, learn a language, create anything. But powering our effort and really creating the alchemy that lets actions create results is the inherent power of prakriti or shakti, which is always shining through our experience. Douglas Brooks, who's a teacher of tantra and a professor of religion, often tells a story about when he was learning Sanskrit in India with his teacher. And Sanskrit's a really hard language. He was having a hard time. And he said to his teacher one day, is this ever going to work? Am I ever going to master this? And his teacher said, well, you have to understand, there are two things operating. There's karma and there's lila. He said, karma is your action. Lila is the power that makes action bear fruit. And that is the power of Shakti. It's the power of Prakriti. Lila means sport or play. You know, so what he was saying is that the action of the universe, which makes our efforts bear fruit, is the action of Prakriti, which, you know, Prakriti is naturally alchemical, which is why the closer we get to really feeling into the essence of Prakriti, the felt sense of consciousness itself, we're able to have more and more alchemical experiences of transforming our karmas. So I want to ask you to listen carefully to what I'm about to say. It's kind of geeky. I'm going to make it as simple as possible, but it's kind of basic Sankhya metaphysics. You know, like all metaphysical Indian teachings, Sankhya philosophy states that everything arises from the inside out. That is, from inside the deepest reaches of your consciousness, which is actually a part of the great consciousness, the source consciousness, as you know. And it is actually the exact opposite of what science or what most scientific reasoning tells us, because most scientific reasoning, especially in the field of contemporary neuroscience in general, assumes that consciousness actually develops out of matter, that it's a property of the brain. I mean, there are different theories about this, and in fact, as many of you know, the issue of what is consciousness is sometimes called the hard problem, because people who believe in physical science don't quite understand how something so fluid and intelligent can develop out of the insensate. Of course, Indian philosophy, Sankhya, Vedanta, Tantra, and Buddhism all agree that the world arises from inside primordial consciousness, which is formless, which is transcendent, which is cannot be defined prior to everything, and every system has a way of naming it. So in Sankhya, the name of that realm of, you know, vast primordial no-thingness is the realm of alinga. Alinga means no sign, no attributes. And within alinga arises what's called mahat, which maha in Sanskrit, as most of you know, means great. So mahat can be defined as the great mind, the primordial mind, and it's basically a synonym for what we call God. So mahat is the source of the physical world, which is actually an expression of its nature. And mahat is a repository of creative power, which is Prakriti. So the primordial creativity of Prakriti, or Shakti, as we would say in the tantric traditions. So within Prakriti are these three basic powers that manifest as everything, which are called sattva, rajas, and tamas, illumination, activity, and stasis, which are constantly interacting and reforming realities at different levels, some very subtle, some quite physical. They operate in the mind. They operate in the physical world. And, the gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are inherent properties of Shakti, and they're said to be the body of Prakriti. The analogy is that Prakriti is like a rope with three strands, which are constantly interweaving. At the highest level, these three powers, the three gunas, are known as divine will, or Ichha Shakti, divine knowledge, or Jnana Shakti, and divine activity, or Kriya Shakti. And these three great powers in the process of manifestation become the powers of the three gunas and manifest universes both inwardly and outwardly. And the point is that these three qualities, sattva, rajas, and tamas, are both the material that the subtle and physical universe is made of, and also the creative powers that work within it. In other words, it's the gunas that are, you know, that are making the seed sprout, that are breaking down the soil in the form of the organisms that do that. This whole ecosystem of this planet is the play of these three gunas. And this universe is, again, this is the Sankhya view, and it's pretty much mirrored in both Tantra and Vedanta, in the two, you know, in the primary Indian darshanas, philosophies. The action of manifesting a universe takes place through stages of the transformation of consciousness, which are called tattvas. And you know, the word tat means divine consciousness, basically. It's as in I am that consciousness, referring to the fact that that primordial power cannot be described. It's beyond form, so the sages call it that. The word tva means essence. So a tattva means the word tattva means essence of that. That is essence of the Supreme Reality, essence of God, if you like that word. So when the manifest world is described as consisting of tattvas, what that means is that it's composed of different stages in the involution of the one divine essence as it shapes worlds out of and within its own great body. As I say, the gunas are the material and the powers that shape that universe. Everything is a combination of gunas. So everything contains elements of luminosity, activity, and stasis. The more sattva there is in anything, the more subtle and luminous it is, and the more it gives the experience of peace and joy. The more rajas, the more active and mobile it is. The more tamas, the denser it is. But so sattva is luminosity, rajas is dynamism, tamas is stability. And if there were only sattva, there would be no material world. Without tamas, we would have no bodies. And if there were no sattva, then the world would either be dead or, you know, or in constant, you know, crazed motion, there would be no equilibrium. Now, here's the thing, and this is why I'm telling you this now, because we're not going to go through the entire tattva chart, even though it's quite interesting if you get into it. But in Sankhya Yoga, it's said that Mahat, the great mind, lives in the individual in the form of our own luminous intelligence, which is what we call buddhi. Buddhi is pure awareness. It's the pure field of awake consciousness. It's the background of all experience. It's the discerner. But buddhi is not just our personal storehouse of higher wisdom and discernment. Buddhi, our awareness, is Mahat itself. It's the great mind. It's Shiva Shakti. It's Ishwara Prakriti. Living within us, we call that in ordinary parlance the Atman or the self. But I find this very exciting to consider that the self, you know, the true self, is actually a very normal, so to speak, part of our mind. It's not some, you know, some higher state that we have to climb into. It's our own buddhi. So when we say that the world is part of the self and comes out of the self, in one sense what we're saying is that the world is part of buddhi and comes out of buddhi, which it's both a stage in the manifestation of the world. It's also the subtlest aspect of human consciousness. So human buddhi is the lens through which cosmic buddhi experiences itself in the world. Briefly, as consciousness becomes more dense in the process of manifestation, other instruments of experience evolve, the ahamkara, the subtle feeling of having a personal existence, the tanmatras, which are the subtle qualities of experience In other words, the subtle sounds, the subtle colors, shapes, tastes, fragrances that exist in the inner world and actually give rise to the physical world. So we experience satan matras in dreams and meditation. We have a complete experience of the world inside ourselves every time we go to sleep. And they're also the basis of physical reality. And along with them, other instruments, the manas, particularly in the senses, appear. And at the end of the process, we have physical manifestation, and including our own bodies and the universe we experience. And the crucial point here is that this is one continuum, all arising from out of the center, which is both beyond us and within us, and which we contact every time we tune into the seer. So Sutra 20 of the Yoga Sutra says, the power of seeing, the sheer power of seeing, of knowing, is the seer. That is to say, the goal of yoga. It is pure, and yet it sees only what the mind shows us. Sorry, it sees only what the mind shows it. So I'll say this again. The sheer power of seeing is the seer. It is pure, and yet it sees only what the mind shows it. The seer, the buddhi, is often compared to a crystal, which is utterly translucent. It's pure, but when you put a red cloth behind a crystal, what it shows you is red. I have a crystal in my window which is looking out onto trees. When I look at it, I see the trees reflected through the crystal, so the crystals become green. And basically, when buddhi is focusing outward, it can only see through the filters of the ego, of the tanmatras, and of the senses. And of course, these filters get thicker as buddhi picks up the samskaras created by the experience of the world that these instruments discern and which these instruments believe is outside our body. Therefore, buddhi as we experience it is a mass of cognitions, of reactions, of thoughts, of images, of feelings, of perceptions. So we don't normally experience our instrument of discernment, which is actually the self, the presence of the self, the God, the unmitigated, unleashed, utterly free godness within us. We don't normally experience it in its clarity because it's covered by the mass of samskaras, and buddhi identifies completely with its contents. So we go back to what we said at the beginning. Our experience of suffering is entirely about where we identify, and it's about where the buddhi identifies. So when your instrument for knowing the difference between what's real and unreal has been completely filled up by, this mass of samskaras and karmas, it can't tell. It can't see what's real in the external world, and it also can't see the fact that Ishvara is completely powering the whole thing. One of the things that Pandit Rajmani, one of the points he makes in his commentary on this sutra, is that we live in two worlds. We live in Ishvara's prakriti, the creation, the drishti is the Sanskrit word, the world, which includes our own mind and senses, but we also live in our personal world, which is the world we constantly create through our filtration system. And what this means is we have to do a lot of sadhana in order for the innate divine powers of buddhi to be available to us. And I'm going to just go one more geeky step here, if that's okay with you. According to Sankhya, the buddhi, the conscious self, has 8 innate powers, 4 of which belong to Ishvara, which are part of Mahat, the great self, and 4 of which are characteristic of the limited self. The first of the four divine powers is Dharma, which in this context means the ability to recognize that everything that exists is made of awareness and love. That's what true Dharma is. It's the recognition of the divine nature of all that exists. The second power is Jnana, or the power of knowing the truth about where the universe comes from and how divinity is expressed in every particle of it. The third is Vairagya, non-attachment, the ability to experience and engage in life without getting stuck in anything, without clinging to some experiences and pushing others away. The fourth quality of Ishvara's buddhi is Aishwarya, which means sovereignty. Aishwarya is a transformation of Ishvara. It's the quality of being of rulership, of, you know, literally being the owner, as it were, of all of this. Ishvara's buddhi has absolute authority, the ability to do whatever it wants to, essentially, to know whatever it wants to create whatever it wants to. And our own powers are limited versions of these four divine powers. So when the human mind starts identifying with its mental contents, these vast abilities are limited, and they actively shrink, contract how our consciousness can experience itself. As those of you who've studied Tantra know, there's a version of this in the Tantric text as well, because the understanding here is that limitation is actually not just a contraction of our ability to see and know, it's also a contraction of our power. It's a condition that's called Shakti Daridriya, or poverty of Shakti. So the first of the limited powers is Adharma, meaning that we're no longer in touch with the love intelligence that moves the cosmos. We neither trust it or live in accordance with it. And of course, that's the source of all of our human woes. Second is Ajnana. And Ajnana here means all the ideas and limiting beliefs that give us the experience that we're separate from the cosmos, and that, of course, are activated and mediated by the samskaras. The third is avairagya, meaning that we cling to anything that helps us feel protected, safe, and comfortable, and try to push away any form of discomfort. Avairagya is pretty much how human beings live our lives, clinging to, you know, our self-image and to anything that makes us feel protected, and doing our very best to eliminate from our lives things that make us feel unsafe or uncomfortable. And the fourth is Anaishwarya, which means that though we try our best to control the environment, we can't. Because our loss of power means that we simply do not have the ability to control our lives. And what we understand about our psychic mechanism that I find quite interesting is that the qualities that characterize the human mind are not just absence, they're also energies, powers in themselves. The more we identify with the cognitions, the more we strengthen those negative and contracted personal powers. So we come back again and again and again to the issue of learning to discern by connecting ourselves with the witness, which by now you've probably figured out is buddhi. You know, the inner witness is the buddhi. And when you tune into the one who knows your thinking or the one who knows you're listening to me, you're actually bringing online the pure buddhi. And that pure quality in buddhi is looking at the samskaras, or the thoughts and feelings that are coming up. Again, buddhi is not an object of consciousness. It's the vehicle, or that is the instrument through which pure consciousness knows itself. What we always want to do when we're doing this particular practice is to keep recentering ourselves in the knowingness and the experience of knowingness. So as you keep asking yourself, what knows I'm hearing her voice, or what knows I'm meditating, or who am I really, without paying attention to the verbal productions that arise, Buddha's naked presence begins to emerge. And in Sutra 23, Patanjali says, the union of our Shakti and the Shakti of Ishvara is the means of experiencing our essential nature. The Sanskrit word here is swaswami shaktyo. Swaswami shaktyo. Swa means your own power. Swami means divine power. Swami means one who is established in the self, the one who is in every particle of the universe. So when we bring our own power and join it with Ishvara's power, which is actually what we're doing when we tune into the witness, that's when the witness begins to reveal itself, to reveal itself as our essential self. Let's just take a few moments now to turn back to the witness. Just start by becoming aware of what's going on in your mind. Sometimes when we ask ourselves to become aware of what's going on in our mind, the mind will shut up because the mind is quite contrary. But at the same time, let your attention come into the heart. Let the breath arise and subside from that space around the physical body, flowing into the heart with hum, flowing with sa as you exhale. Just nestle into the heart space and see if at the same time you can become aware of that in you that knows you're meditating. And as you allow your attention to touch and access that witnessing consciousness, even if it's only for a second or two, have this bhava, this active imagination. Feel that the witness is a loving, benign presence who watches you through what we could call a window in the back of your mind, who's looking in the window of your contracted consciousness and watching you, meditating, making this effort to see through the thoughts to the one who knows it. And feel that this witness, this loving witness, this compassionate witness, is also holding you. I might even go so far as to say rooting for you, intending the best for you, holding space for you, as you engage in this latest moment of becoming aware of that part of you that is free. And we're just going to settle into this meditation, following the breath, allowing the breath to arise and subside with Hansa, and from time to time becoming aware that we are being seen, held, known by the witness who is our own highest self, our buddhi, who is also the great self, the great lover, whose entire play is calibrated for our fulfillment and freedom. So just let yourself meditate with that awareness. as you come out of meditation, I want to ask you to take this sutra, which will come in your homework. The union of our Shakti and the Shakti of Ishwara is the means of experiencing our essential nature. And we're going to work with it and contemplate it this week. And I want to give a kind of a hint here of what I believe is one of the secrets of, let's call it the tantric view of what the Yoga Sutras want to teach us. The shaktis, the powers, both within ourselves and within the universe, are many, and the ones we identify with are the ones that are going to expand. And there is no question that some of these energies are going to manifest as our deluding and suffering-producing samskaras. They were going to manifest as kleshas. They're going to manifest as karma, through our karmas. And there are others which manifest through liberating activities, which enhance our meditation, which bring us wisdom. And as yogis, we, of course, want to identify and follow the liberating ones. But there is another point of view which is not exactly the opposite or an alternative, but a kind of enhancement of this one, which is what Sutra 18 is about, which is that this world is a huge game. I would say it's the original world-building game, way more sophisticated than Fortnite or any of the other, you know, great world games, you know, in which the purpose is to fully experience your circumstances, to struggle with different developmental tasks, and ultimately to realize that there's something beyond your limited power that can actually do a much better job of playing the game of your life than you can relying entirely on your own mind. So, yes, the goal of the game is to fully know the source of it, to not just realize intellectually, but realize as a full body experience our own identity with the divine. But at the same time, there wouldn't be a game if we didn't start out with this propensity to identify with our limited powers. And moreover, we're not just here to ignore the world. We're here to play in it, to engage it, to love and to work and to serve, to get heartbroken and move beyond it. And this is what the great sages show us. You know, the greatest sages are not just guys who sit in caves, though certainly most of them do for periods of time in their lives, but they're highly functional and skillful and magical in their abilities. So we have all those capacities, and they begin to come online as we start to unite our personal Shakti, our personal power, with Ishwara's power, to unite Swa Shakti with Swami Shakti. So I leave you with that, and with that exploration, which is of the greatest importance at this moment in time when there's so much going on in the world that actually needs healing, and in which we have, to some degree, the power to affect, certainly in our own world, and for some of us in the wider world. So what will happen in your sadhana and in your life as you join your personal power to Ishwara's power? What possibilities emerge? And as we enter into the next phase of the Yoga Sutras, which is an exploration of the Ashtanga, the eight limbs of yoga, which is utterly core to what these sutras are offering us, let's go into it with the intention to make that union, and see where it leads us. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful week. Your homework will be coming. And I just send you the greatest love. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वे न च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मेय चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानंद रूपा शिवोहं 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 शिवोहं।